Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
The cow from KCRW Santa Monica, this is Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. We're continuing our special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing. Today's subject is African-American writers and identity. My guest is poet Rita Dove. I'll also be speaking with Edward P. Jones and Alice Walker. This is poet, spoken word artist, and activist Jane Cortez.
I really became political, very political, and learned a lot about history and politics in the civil rights movement. I went to Mississippi in the 1960s. In 1963, I worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the voter registration projects. And my task was to find out what was going on in Mississippi and come back to Los Angeles and sort of help organize a Friends of SNCC group, which is what I did. And so I became very politicized at that time. Therefore, merging my poetry with the political was just fine. It all worked for me. It just all worked. And so... Later, in 1967, I moved to New York City. After coming back from Mississippi, I then became involved with the Watts workshop. It was Studio Watts at that time. It was with a group of people who decided that they wanted to have some sort of workshop, some visible kind of a place to teach young people about the arts. And I told them I thought they should do it in Watts because I grew up in Watts. And so they did. They found a place, and we started a workshop there. And this was all before the 1965 rebellion. So I was there directing plays and teaching drama and putting plays together.
Now, there has been an interest in identity, in poetry as the voice of identity, and as almost a banner for identity movements, whether that's women, people of color, gay people. And as a result, poetry has become, I think, identified in America when it becomes popular as the voice of a minority, if you know what I mean. And even those academics who patrol poetry are just another minority. Could we talk about
that? That's somebody choosing a word that has a meaning that should mean what you are, but it is not. It's not that. Maybe poetry is the wrong word, or it's taken the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it's someone saying to me that, oh, to be a poet, then you had to be like this, this, and this, but that's not true.
Uh-huh.
So,
or maybe I never meant to be a poet to begin with.
Right.
That's your word.
Yeah, so you have to find something that's outside of that, even though it's called that. But you have to find a meaning of your own identity, or your identity outside of that, not the identity that's already fixed into that. You know, like, that's my mother, that's my father, you know, this, then you're the poet.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be that simple.
That was Jane Cortez. Edward P. Jones won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Known World.
It's a central event, the stout stick, I think, that Sally Gordon once told Flannery O'Connor you needed to start a novel, you needed to plant a stout stick somewhere, is the death of the master, Henry Townsend. And we learn within a couple of paragraphs that Henry Townsend was a black man, that he owned 33 slaves, that he was 31 years old. And from that point on, in a sense, we leave the known world.
Yeah.
In other words, whatever we know about slavery and its justifications are going to be stood on their head.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're going to have to rethink this entirely as something. Here we have a town, it is fictional, but based in history, Manchester, where there are, of the 35 black families who have managed to purchase their freedom, eight of them owned slaves. Mm-hmm. When had you first learned that there were slave-owning black families?
In sometime in college. And I don't remember if a professor mentioned it in passing or if it was some footnote. I just remember coming upon that and being rather quite surprised, of course, because up until then slavery had always been black and white, you know, and here you come across this thing where black people participated in a system that was oppressing everyone else. At that time, when I learned about it, I had no intentions of becoming a writer, so I just sort of filed it away in my head, along with a lot of other things you learn when you're in college.
Well, there's one section in which we hear a shout taking place at the level of a whisper, and I wonder if you'll read it for us, because it's one of these places where you can't help but be aware of what the novelist is feeling, because you're feeling it as a reader, too. Caldonia, who's having trouble maintaining her plantation and her slaves the way her husband maintained them, is speaking with a life insurance salesman who's offering masters life insurance for the slaves.
Tops told her that for 15 cents a head every 2 months, her property, each working slave over 5 years old, would be protected from just about everything God could think of. Getting kicked in the head by a mule while working a field, dying from tainted food, as long as the doctor could certify the food was not simply rancid and that any normal person could have eaten it and not had the same death visited upon him. Breaking a neck in a well after falling down in it while cleaning it out. Getting bit by a snake of 1 foot or longer while working in the fields or the barn or the smokehouse or the tobacco barn or the corn crib. Said snake, alive or dead, would soon be missing fang or fangs, would have to be produced to collect on the policy. Slave death by mad dogs in fall, winter, or spring was compensable. Canine madness in the summer was an ordinary act of God to be expected, so the policy was mute about that season. Nothing came from the loss of an arm or of one or both eyes, because such losses were not the best indicia of how much work a slave could still perform. Being hurt in any fashion by duly authorized slave catchers was compensable. Plain citizens, opportunistic slave catchers just out to make a dollar, hurting a runaway, would make that provision in the policy null and void. Being killed or injured by a neighbor while walking across a neighbor's property while on an errand of consequence for the master or the mistress or their issue. No money for a slave hurt or killed by someone while said slave was visiting his family on another plantation. Being accidentally shot while assisting the master, mistress, their issue, while hunting or while traveling, with said people, as long as travel was of 3 days' duration or longer. Being struck by lightning while working in the field, as long as recuperation was less than 3 days, and as long as the slave had not been given sufficient warning that lightning was about to strike. Death by lightning was not compensable. Such deaths were simply another ordinary act of God that the company, in its wisdom, could not reward.
That was Edward P. Jones reading from his novel, The Known World. I spoke with poet Rita Dove about her book, American Smooth, published by Norton, and I sensed in this book in particular that what had happened to you twice, when you won the Pulitzer Prize for Thomas and Beulah, and then when you were named Poet Laureate, that you speak then for an ethnicity, if not your own family, but a whole culture. Here the movement is almost opposite. I want to be transfigured, seem to be the messages coming between the poems.
That's fascinating. I think it's true. I mean, I think I've always had the impulse to move away from being a spokesperson for a particular group, be it women or being African Americans, and toward, I think, really the essence of what an artist is. At the same time, recognizing that without my even saying anything, by the very virtue of who I am, I'm going to be a role model and a spokesperson. So this is a kind of a it's a struggle. Well, it's actually a kind, it's a tension more, a tension that I've always been aware of and have been working with all my life. That is one reason why sometimes I think I write so many poems which are in persona, as if to say, you cannot nail me down here or here. You know, I'm the X marks the spot. And because this is a persona poem, now slip into this person's skin and slip into this one, and do not assume that this is a unified outlook, really.
This is a poem dedicated to Hattie McDaniel, and this is Rita Dove reading from American Smooth.
Hattie McDaniel arrives at the coconut grove late, in aqua and ermine, gardenias scaling her left sleeve in a spasm of scent, her gloves white, her smile chastened, purse giddy with stars and rhinestones clipped to her brilliantined hair, on her free arm that fine Negro, Mr. Wonderful Smith. It's the day that isn't, February 29th, at the end of the shortest month of the year, and the shittiest, too, everywhere except Hollywood, California, where the maid can wear mink and still be a maid, bobbing her bandaged head and cursing the white folks under her breath as she smiles and shoos their silly daughters in from the night dew. What can she be thinking of, striding into the ballroom where no black face has ever showed itself except above a serving tray? Hi Hat Hattie, Mama Mac, her haughtiness, the little lady from Showboat whose name Bing forgot, Beulah and Bertha and Melina and Carrie and Violet and Cynthia and Fidelia, one half of the Dark Barrymores. Dear Mammy, we can't help but hug you, crawl into your generous lap, tease you with arch innuendo so we can feel that much more wicked and youthful and sleek. But oh, what we forgot. The four husbands, the phantom pregnancy, your famous parties, your celebrated icebox cake. Your giggle above the red petticoats rustle, black girl and white girl walking hand in hand down the railroad tracks in Kansas City, 6 years old. The man who advised you, now that you were famous, to begin eliminating your more common acquaintances, and your reply catching him square in the eye. That's a good idea. I'll start right now by eliminating you. Is she or isn't she? 3 million dishes, a truckload of aprons and head rags later, and here you are, poised between husbands and factions, no corset wide enough to hold you in, your huge face a dark moon split by that spontaneous smile, your trademark, your curse. No matter, Hattie. It's a long, beautiful walk into that flower-smothered standing ovation. So go on and make them wait.
Rita Dove, reading Hattie McDaniel, arrives at the Coconut Grove from her book American Smooth. Now, the first thing I notice is that instead of bobbing her bandanaed head, we get bobbing her bandaged head. And it's kind of amazing. Later in the poem, the bandana will be called a head rag.
Mm-hmm.
And we're being asked to think of this trademark of Hattie McDaniel's as being a wound.
Yes, yes. As being a wound, as being also and something that is
shameful in some way with the rag. It's so easy. Words are so, I mean, they're so insidious. It's so easy to fall into the stereotypical response that one has when you see the head wrapping, let's say, you know, to make it more neutral at this moment. And to say bandanaed head just would have blasted for me the image I was trying to create for her at that moment and what it means for her to arrive in Aqua and Ermine instead of with that wound, that display. Also, I wanted to get at that feeling of the usefulness of this head wrapping, where it comes from and why it's used. It really is used because originally it was to shield the head from sun, to protect it, to keep the sweat off of you as you worked in the fields. And so it was something that was meant, well, it was something, it was a health matter, basically. And it became an emblem for subservitude. I wanted to bring it back to its pain.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Rita Dove, the author of American Smooth, published by Norton. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Rita Dove about her book, American Smooth. Now, the last section of the book is very moving to me because it seems, in particular, to move into the realm of dream rather than the realm of identity. But in particular, I wanted to look at the last poem, which is called Looking Up from the Page, I Am Reminded of This Mortal Coil. This is Rita Dove reading the final poem from her new book, American Smooth.
Looking up from the page, I am reminded of this mortal coil. Mercurial ribbon licking the cut lip of the Blue Ridge. Daybreak or end, I can't tell as long as I ignore the body's marching orders, as long as I am alive in air. What good is the brain without traveling shoes? We put our thoughts out there on the Cosmos Express, and they hurtle on, tired and frightened, bundled up in their worrisome shawls and gloves. I'm just guessing here, but I suspect we don't travel easily at all, though we keep making better wheels, smaller phones and wider webs, ye old significant glance across the half-empty goblet of Chardonnay. The blaze freshens. 5 or 6 miniature birds strike up the band. Daybreak, of course. No more strobe and pink gels from the heavenly paint shop. Just house lights, plays over. Time to gather your things and go home.
Now, I think that's amazing. Now, I ask the listener to bear in mind that's the last poem in the book. And essentially, if I'm reading this right, the poet is leaving the book, the
yes.
theater of the book, to go back into private life.
Yes.
That the gels and the theater, the lights are now off. And what she sees is her own home. Now, this is so interestingly different because often as not, poetry presents its orders as the realer world.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this, poetry is being, in a sense, left and acknowledged as a place, almost like Eden, that you leave to return to the dailiness of life, and that however full of heightened artifice and truth poetry may be, still you have to go back into the world of things. This may not be a happy world. It may not be easy to travel out of the poem, away from these desks or out of the bed. There's a good deal of mental traveling, as Blake says. But ultimately, life in a certain way is not here. And you're being sent exiled into the world in this final poem to a place where you are no longer a spokesperson for anything.
I'm just smiling here because I haven't had anyone really address this poem, and they think of it as being a little, they think of it as being not as serious as it is, and I think it's an extremely serious poem. It is, I'm cautioning the reader, in a sense, to realize that a poetry, though it is perhaps more about the real world or the real emotions than many forms of art present on the surface. I mean, in other words, it will address it more directly, that there is still a level of artifice and a level of comfort in poetry, no matter how devastating the event may be, that may not be there in regular life because we don't articulate it, because we go into the world of things. And even while I would say that the poem is about the idea that after I've finished writing, and I'm a night person, so that I do write all night, and my idea of ecstasy is to write all night and to have the sun come up and then say it's time to go to bed. So absolutely reversed for most people. That even though the house lights come up, the play is over, and it's time to gather my things and go home, and the home then becomes the real world. It's the world with where poetry will not comfort me. But at the same time, it is home. It's a place where other things can comfort me too. It's I read the ending as being ambivalent as well. It's an exile from the world where, if things go right, the poem works and the puzzle comes together and you feel that incredible satisfaction that comes from that aesthetic completion. But I also, there's a certain kind of, well, it was a great play and now I can go and relax at home. So there's also a warning that there are masks in poems as well.
That was Rita Dove. I talked with Alice Walker about her novel, Now Is the Time to Open Your Heart. The last time I spoke to Alice Walker, she moved me deeply by explaining to me that her interest in writing was not just in being a good writer, but doing writing that changes the world, that changes the way we think about the world. And that is a different approach to writing, I think, than many people have when they're young and trying to get every detail right and trying to get a literary sensibility established. Now the act of writing seems to me for you to be much more joyful, and I think to be about the effect of the book on the world rather than the interplay of the book with itself. The old literary idea of a hall of mirrors, is this word right? Is that comma in the right place? Those are no longer the first level of concern, it seems to me. Am I right?
Yes, and also I had to think of changing writing to change the world, Michael, so that I could live in the world. The world that I inherited was one that was not designed for my life. It was designed for my death. And I intend to live fully, you know, as me, in this world. By the time I reached my early 50s, I knew that I wanted to think about what the second half of my life would be like, and I wanted it to be ever more deep and ever more true and ever more directed by what is a necessity for me to live fully. So it meant really reassessing everything I had done up to that point and letting go of a lot of things that I really didn't need any longer.
What has it been like for you to make that decision?
When I started writing, I thought the world was solid, and I thought the world was always with us, and I thought that our species was always with us. But as I have grown older and as we look at the situation of the world, we see that things have changed drastically. And I think the fact that the world is calling to us, you know, is what this book answers. I stopped writing for 3 years. I just felt like, well, no, you know, maybe I just will not do it. And yet the world is calling. And so I feel that this is a response to that call, because actually I love the world. I'm not one of those people who's ready to go to heaven. I feel like I'm already in heaven. Uh-huh. You know, and I want to work on this heaven so that it is healthy, you know, and glossy and fine and vibrant, and we as people can enjoy it and be happy.
Now, what I would say is that the metaphor for this book is conversation. It's the conversation between Yolo and Kate, that this is a couple who have been close, like the two strands in a DNA molecule, but they're ready to go off and recode, essentially, with other groups in new directions. And this is, one goes to the Amazon, the other to Hawaii, and they work with spiritual teachers and return to discover that their conversation can be continued. Is literature that conversation for you with the reader?
It is. It is, because sometimes you feel like, you know, they've gone on and you've gone on too. And yet, because you're both deeply involved in the world, of course new things happen and new understandings occur and new visions are seen. And then you come back and you share those. That's why I, even though my arm gets very tired when I'm signing a lot of times, I really enjoy the faces of the people and looking into their eyes, because we are on journeys, all of us. And sometimes, especially at my book signings, I can see that in people, and it's wonderful.
That was Alice Walker. My other guests today were Jane Cortez, Edward P. Jones, and Rita Dove. This show is part of our continuing series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing, produced by Michael Silverblatt, Melinda Siegel, and Alan Howard. The engineer is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.